This week, the U.S. dirty wars finally faced justice as Blackwater contractors were found guilty in a 2007 massacre. Here to tell us why the real people behind these crimes will never face justice is Academy Award nominee, two-time George Polk Book Award winner, and co-founding editor of The Intercept, investigative reporter, war correspondent, author of Dirty Wars, Jeremy Scahill. Good morning, Jeremy.
Good morning. I'm here.
Jeremy will be speaking at the 35th annual dinner celebration for Chicago Area Peace Action. It's a dinner and conversation with Jeremy Scahill, and it takes place next Saturday, November 1st at 6 p.m. at the St. Francis Xavier Parish Gym at 549 9th Street in Wilmette. Tickets for just the program start at $20, and for the dinner start at $75. For more information, visit Chi Peace Action. That's CHIPeaceAction.org. Jeremy, I seriously doubt that you remember this. And to tell you the truth, I don't remember it either. But apparently you were on the show like 13 years ago, and I do not remember that conversation. So I apologize.
Had you been drinking at the time?
No,
I actually, because it has such a distinct name, I remember, I'm pretty sure that I was driving in a car at the time that we spoke, but I definitely know that I've been on this show before.
I know, too, and I found, see, that's the funny part, is I found an old rundown that said Jeremy Scahill, and then I was like, I know he's been on this. So anyway, we were speaking earlier with Doug Henwood about his piece in Harper's on Hillary Clinton, where Doug doesn't see much difference between the Republican and Democratic foreign policy platforms, except maybe the Republicans may go isolationist, while Hillary could go even more militant. We've been talking about this lack of difference since the 2000 presidential debate on foreign policy between Gore and Bush, when Jim Lehrer was asking, is there anywhere you two disagree? The conversation has really taken off over the last few months because we've been talking to Tufts University's Michael J. Glennon about the national security state, our double government of national security policymakers who never change, thus giving the U.S. a consistent foreign policy that does not change ever. So will the dirty wars end? Can they end? Are they on auto pilot, and is some isolationist Republican more likely to at least reel in the dirty wars than Hillary would?
Well, I mean, the short answer is no. I think that what's happened really since the era of Ronald Reagan is that when it comes to American what they now are calling national security policy, you could call it also sort of offensive war policy. It's been consistent from one administration to the next, and it's all of the excesses have sort of built on each other. And the role that the Democrats have played has been to sort of try to clean up the image of America around the world while continuing or sort of rubber stamping or legitimizing the policies of their Republican predecessors. And I think that the enduring legacy of Barack Obama when it comes to foreign policy is that he is going to be viewed as the man who ensured that some of the most abusive, outrageous policies of the Bush era were codified into actual standing U.S. policy. And what I mean by that is that when Barack Obama was a senator, when he was running for the nomination to be the Democratic candidate for president, he talked a good game about civil liberties, about American foreign policy. It was pretty clear that he was no radical leftist or some big anti-war guy, but his politics definitely energized a lot of young people who had basically grown up in the shadow of 9/11, and that was their entire existence. Was overshadowed by the fact that the country that they lived in was in a permanent state of war. And then Obama gets into office, and he surrounds himself with Clinton era hawks, including Hillary Clinton, who was one of the most aggressive secretaries of state in modern U.S. history, probably second only to Henry Kissinger in terms of militarizing what is supposed to be one of the top diplomatic posts in the U.S. government. And at the end of the day, I think that what Obama did was to try to put a new label or a new branding on the Bush-Cheney policies and then run with them around the globe. And at the same time, pick up a Nobel Peace Prize and claim that he sort of changed the way that the U.S. does its foreign policy. At the end of the day, I think that Obama has made it so that whoever the next president is, is going to have a lot of latitude to continue waging these dirty wars. And I don't buy the notion that an isolationist Republican, first of all, is going to win the office of the presidency, but second, would actually radically change anything. Just look what's happening with Rand Paul. Go back 2 years ago, Rand Paul was, you know, basically like his father on foreign policy, Ron Paul, where he was pretty much an isolationist. Now, Rand Paul is popping up with all sorts of justifications for various wars and critiquing President Obama for not fighting war in the right way or being tough enough. Once you get polished and ready for the big game, they pretty much strip you of anything that vaguely resembles a principle.
Well, that's an incredibly depressing answer, and that's why you're on This Is Hell, Jeremy. you know, one of the things that I was thinking about while you were talking is the way in which the Obama administration is continuing the Bush administration programs. They're actually putting those programs on steroids. And you see, unfortunately, with Barack Obama, for instance, President Obama, his approval ratings were dropping and dropping, and then he got a little bit of a slight uptick once he said that he was going to start the bombing campaign against ISIS. My real fear, Jeremy, isn't that people don't know about the dirty wars that the United States is engaged in. My real fear is that if they did know about them, they would support them. How popular do you think, how much of the reason that we have these dirty wars going on right now is that they're actually popular with the American public?
Well, I mean, there's. I think you're making an excellent point, and I agree with you. The issue, though, is are they being presented with the reality of what that war is about and who the so-called enemy actually is, or are they being presented with what is essentially a very nicely, neatly packaged piece of propaganda? And you know, if you look at who our so-called enemies have been in recent years, you know, it was Al-Qaeda, and then, you know, Osama bin Laden gets killed, and then we find, you know, oh, it's Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, this group in Yemen, and then Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, you know, it continues to be who it was 5 years ago, but then we need a new enemy, so we say, oh, here's ISIS, and then for a while, they had this thing called the Khorasan Group, and there was this great, one night on, I was watching NBC Nightly News, which I don't often do, and Brian Williams was anchoring, and right next to him, you know, was this huge graphic on the TV, and it just says, you know, the new enemy, and it's, you know, I was sort of joking around with Amy Goodman about this not too long ago, saying, like, we could roll that out basically like every year or every few months and sort of make it an American holiday where we just sort of present the new enemy. So I don't think it's that Americans, you know, are sort of love war or think, hey, we're doing the right thing in the world, around the world, by engaging in all these bombing campaigns. We have lazy journalists who are being fed propaganda by Republicans and Democrats alike and are sort of just repeating that propaganda. This was something that was very clear when Bush was in office, and it remains true when Obama's in office. But I disagree, not saying that you're saying it in such an oversimplified way, but I don't agree with the notion that if the American people were presented with the actual facts of who we're fighting against, what the reasons we're fighting against them actually are, and what threat they actually pose, I do not believe that most Americans would support it either morally or perhaps, you know, to make a bread and butter argument, financially. And at the end of the day, the thesis of my reporting over the past 15 years has been that we're helping to create the very threat that we claim to be fighting because of our aggressive, offensive foreign policy against relatively minor threats in the scheme of things. Our overreaction and our ultra-militarized response to the slightest whiff of something we can vaguely define as terrorism ends up fueling the very terrorism that we, you know, we're told that they're fighting against in our names.
So kicking ass sells, but when you tell people why the war that you're going to engage in and why you're engaging that war and who you're targeting, that would undo it, right?
Well, I'm not so sure. I mean, as they say in Star Wars, the power of the Force is fierce. I mean, there's a conspiracy in this country that no longer requires sort of, you know, white men with cigars smoking in a back room cutting a deal.
Right.
The conspiracy is that corporations already sort of are in control of everything. And it's sort of, we kind of have a shadow parallel government, but it's not like the Illuminati or the Bilderberg Group are sort of running the world. It's become its own beast to the point where there was a sort of silent coup in this country where corporations and corporate interests just by default are going to be the primary beneficiary of whatever policies Democrats or Republicans choose to implement. And part of that has to do with the fact that corporations control our electoral process, and part of it has to do with the fact that that the elites in both the Democratic and Republican parties are the same people that are the corporate elites. And so it's not that they're sort of calculating how can we make more money for Boeing and Lockheed Martin and all of these defense contractors. It's that the entire system is rigged so that the only policies that can actually pass are those that will favor the bottom line of corporate profits. And so I don't think that it's just a matter of providing information that's going to change people's minds. The fact is that every single member of Congress is bought and paid for by one private interest or another, and many of them by the same interests. And that's big pharma, it's big defense, it's big oil. It's huge amounts of capital are amassed against the people to ensure that corporations and corporate personhood is something more than just sort of a sick joke at the Supreme Court having to do with campaign finance and interference in elections, but that corporate personhood means that corporations are people above actual human beings, and that's the default policy. So it's not just about information. It's also about the fact that a huge amount of time and money over many, many decades has gone into creating a system that is rigged against the people.
So is the continuation, I shouldn't say is, the continuation of the dirty wars is partly the media's fault. I was talking to somebody who is a telecommunications professor, and I was asking him, you know, why is it that CNN, for instance, I was telling him the difference between CNN and CNN International. I was studying for a couple of weeks, watching both and trying to see what the difference was. And I was asking him, you know, why is it that CNN is so different from CNN International? Why is it that CNN seems to be so pro-war and pro-militant reaction to any challenge that the United States faces around the world? And he said, well, I'm sure that they're watching their Nielsen track ratings and they see that it sells. So is the reason that the media is at least partly at fault for the continuation of the dirty wars simply because they see ratings and capitalism tells them that being patriotic and being for war sells stuff?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure I entirely agree with that. I mean, I think that I think that's sort of what happened after 9/11 when Fox News started to put this huge American flag that was waving on the bottom of the screen, and then this whole sort of symbolism of needing to have the American flag on the lapels of American politicians. And you know, Dan Rather at one point said that you know he would have been necktied if he had sort of spoken out against the sort of rush to war after 9/11 when he was the anchor of the CBS Evening News. I mean, I think there is some level of basic cowardice that exists at the higher levels of media institutions where they don't want to be perceived as being unpatriotic. And I think to an extent that can impact it. But, you know, you're asking something, and part of the reason why I'm kind of stuttering here is because you're asking about ratings. And if you actually want to talk about that, war and patriotism, it doesn't sell. That's not actually what people are gravitating toward on television. What they're gravitating toward is sort of what we're told is called reality TV. You know, more people keep up with the Kardashians than keep up with whatever latest war Obama and his people have gotten us into. And I think that if anything, it's not that we're necessarily seeing a glorification of war as a sort of expanding trend on our media. That's always been consistent. I would say we're actually seeing a radical reduction in the coverage of American wars, even if it's ultra patriotic or pseudo patriotic or whatever. And that what you're seeing on CNN and Fox and MSNBC is starting to look a hell of a lot like what you're seeing on Bravo with the Real Housewives of New Jersey. So, you know, I actually think that, you know, if you look at Ted Koppel, who was the founder and longtime anchor of a show on ABC that young people in your audience probably never saw called Nightline, that was a show that was remarkable. I mean, it had its problems. We used to joke that it was White Line because they would only ever interview white people, but it was started out of the hostage crisis in Iran, where the U.S. embassy was seized by students who participated in overthrowing a U.S.-backed dictatorship in Iran, And Nightline, which was on network television, this was before cable news. It was on like any television box that you turned on anywhere that you could see this show. It was a huge deal before cable to have a network show. And for an hour every night, Ted Koppel and all of these great international reporters at ABC News were covering this amazing, incredible story. And then the show stayed on the air, and it was probably the most serious show on television. Why was that show taken off the air? The show was taken off the air because no advertisers wanted to support it anymore. Ted Koppel was patriotic, in according to their definition. Ted Koppel was waving the flag big time, you know, whenever America got into a war. He also was a good reporter when he didn't have to sort of, you know, stand up and be a spokesperson for the government. No one wanted to watch it, or everyone wanted to watch it, but no advertisers wanted to support it. So who wins? The audience, who says this is a great show and the ratings are high, or advertisers who say, I don't want to sell my product next to a report about a kid getting blown up somewhere. So you understand what I'm saying? Like, I think that's more, if you want a real lesson in idiocy on television, watch Morning Joe with Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski on MSNBC. And I've been on that show many times. I mean, that is where America goes to get the dumbest, lowest common denominator version of whatever happens to be happening around the globe.
Yeah, one thing I just want to back up what you were saying about Nightline is that Nightline consistently had more than twice the ratings of The Tonight Show and The Late Show combined.
Correct.
Whatever the CBS and NBC competition was, they would have more than twice the ratings, and they couldn't even bill a quarter of any one of those two shows because they simply couldn't get advertisers. Which...
Exactly. So that's the point I'm making, is that, you know, in response to what
right.
your previous guest said, it's not that I don't think that that plays a role.
Right.
It's that, you know, it doesn't war doesn't sell.
Mm.
And you know, a lot of advertisers don't want their products being advertised when there's something depressing on television. They want to hit that sweet demographic of people, you know, who are at the prime of their working life, that are sort of urban working people or people with a compulsive need to spend. So they're are sitting at home on computers. They're targeting certain individuals. It's not just like that they want everybody, you know, if most of the country is watching a particular show, that doesn't necessarily mean advertisers want to do it. Who is watching that show? That's why when you watch CNN during the day, you will see an extraordinary number of Viagra advertisements. Why is that? Because the advertisers have studied who's watching those shows
right.
at that time, and they're targeting it to men in an age group with erectile dysfunction. It's not because they just, Viagra decided they're going to buy advertising at 1:30. No. People spent a lot of money to do a study figuring out when is the best time to sell Viagra on television and what is the best channel to do it on. And that's what they're doing it. So I'm sure they're targeting the Senate, basically.
And, you know, another great example of that is golf on TV. Golf historically gets horrible ratings. The only time it ever got good ratings was with Tiger Woods, but it gets horrible ratings. So why is it on every Saturday and Sunday afternoon? Because they bill incredibly high, because the target audience for golf is people who have tons of money. So you can get really big advertisers like Porsche or whoever to be on during a golf show. So it's more about the revenue that they create, not just the ratings numbers. We are speaking with Jeremy Scahill. He is a producer and writer of the award-winning film Dirty Wars. The book of that same title just came out in a paperback version last month. He is going to be speaking at the 35th annual dinner celebration for Chicago Area Peace Action. It's a dinner and conversation with Jeremy Scahill, and it takes place next Saturday, November 1st at 6 p.m. at the St. Francis Xavier Parish Gym at 549 9th Street in Wilmette. Tickets for just the program start at $20, and for the dinner start at $75. For more information, visit chipeaceaction.org. That's C-H-I peaceaction.org. I want to talk to you about your article, your most recent writing, your post this week at The Intercept. Blackwater founder remains free and rich while his former employees go down on murder charges. On the Blackwater guilty verdict, Ronald Matchin, U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia, and said in a statement, "This verdict is a resounding affirmation of the commitment of the American people to the rule of law, even in times of war. 7 years ago, these Blackwater contractors unleashed powerful sniper fire, machine guns, and grenade launchers on innocent men, women, and children. Today, they were held accountable for that outrageous attack and its devastating consequences for so many Iraqi families." And here's a quote from the AP on the verdict. "One of those struck by gunfire in the shootings, Hassan Jabir, said in Baghdad that, quote, at last we are hearing good news where justice has been achieved and Blackwater will receive their punishment. How much is this a victory for justice when it comes to the Iraq War? And do you think there will be any lingering impact, any legacy of this decision, maybe more oversight when it comes to military contractors in the future?
Well, on a micro level, this is a very important verdict because it's the first time that private security contractors, I prefer the term mercenaries, have been held accountable in any criminal form for killing civilians under the auspices of the so-called War on Terror. And this was the single largest known massacre of civilians committed by any private security entity that we're aware of. And, you know, the fact is that, there were many men that were involved with the shooting that day as part of a Blackwater team called Raven 23, and they systematically gunned down 17 Iraqi civilians. They were tried for the deaths of 14 of them, but there were 17 Iraqi civilians killed, including children and an Iraqi medical student and his wife. And I know many of the personal stories of the people who were killed that day because I've talked to their family members. And it would be hard to exaggerate the level of horror that was present in this in the square that day. I mean, one guy, Mohammed Kanani, whose 9-year-old son was killed, described it to me. He said it was like the end of days, and just shooting bullets everywhere. And then, you know, so one man who was killed early on in the shooting, they just kept repeatedly going back to him as they would shoot other people. Then they would come back and shoot his corpse. He was just completely riddled with rounds fired by these guys. But there were many other people than the four men who were on trial there that were responsible for this massacre. One other guy, he pled out earlier to a lesser charge and then was a key witness against his fellow colleagues. But I'm not just talking about the guys in the square. This was a company, Blackwater, that was created by a neo-crusader who is a radical Christian supremacist named Eric Prince, who is a billionaire. And he and the other executives at his company set a tone where the killing of Muslims was permissible, whether they were combatants or not. And people at Blackwater spoke of teams of operatives flying in helicopters going what they called night hunting, where they literally were shooting Iraqis for sport and using very racist terms to describe Muslims and others, and basically viewed them as Eric Prince once said, as sort of crawling out of the sewers and creating this barbaric threat around the world. And that's the tone that existed at this company. So, you know, I'm glad, and I think it's important that an American jury saw the criminality of that event. But let's be clear here. Eric Prince is still a free man. He just wrote a book, which is a revisionist memoir of his time at the head of Blackwater, called Civilian Warriors, and he describes Blackwater as the unsung heroes of the War on Terror. He recently started a new mercenary company called Frontier Services Group, which is backed by huge amounts of Chinese capital, which is interesting given that Prince portrays himself as an ultra-patriot. They're targeting Africa. And he recently suggested on Fox News that Blackwater or other private contractors like that should be used to fight ISIS or respond to Ebola. President Bush isn't going to be held accountable. Dick Cheney won't be held accountable for unleashing mercenary forces around the world. Donald Rumsfeld won't be. You could tell a lot about what's happening in this country by looking at who's in prison and who's on a book tour. When it comes to former officials, people like John Kiriakou, who was a CIA whistleblower, he's in prison. Chelsea Manning, who did WikiLeaks, she's in prison. And yet Jose Rodriguez, the architect of the CIA Black Sites program, he's on book tour. Eric Prince, the head of this Christian crusader force that gunned down, Iraqi, Afghan, other civilians, he's on book tour. Donald Rumsfeld, Leon Panetta, they're on book tour. Whistleblowers are in jail. Ed Snowden is in exile. So it's a mixed bag. It's a micro victory and very important for the Iraqis who were affected by it, but it's a spit in the ocean of what actually is needed in terms of actual accountability.
But when it comes to actual accountability, I know that you were saying that Eric Prince had said all these horrible things and had created a culture and an environment within Blackwater that would lead to these awful crimes. But the only way that I could see that he would be held accountable is if there was paperwork or some sort of record or evidence that showed that he then ordered these types, this killing or these kinds of killings.
Well, it's interesting that you say that. I mean, there's a lot of smoke around Eric Prince and about specific incidents, and there are allegations from whistleblowers within the company that Eric Prince was directly involved with actual specific killings. But those haven't, they haven't been considered valid enough to end up in a court of law. I personally believe that it's Eric Prince, as the head of that company and setting a tone in the way that he did publicly within the company, should be held accountable to one degree or another. But when it comes to like linking him to the actual Nisr Square massacre, no, of course he didn't wake up that morning and say, "Hey, go and shoot a bunch of Iraqis in a square." But we also need to look at how do we hold, if companies are people under our laws, then why can't they get the death penalty the way that so many, poor African Americans do who can't afford big lawyers? And so when I say accountable for Eric Prince, I mean it in a greater sense than simply was he involved with the Nisr Square killing. It's what did his company do under his leadership in a systematic, provable, documentable way.
Just a couple more questions for you, Jeremy. I know you got to go. There's a new movie coming out this weekend in New York and next weekend here in Chicago by your colleague at The Intercept, Laura Poitras. Am I pronouncing her last name correctly?
Yes.
All right. I thought it was going to be French, like Poitras.
Poitras. You could call her that. I don't think she would object.
Laura Poitras, called Citizen Four, about U.S. surveillance in general, but Edward Snowden specifically. You're in the movie discussing new disclosures from a new anonymous government source. From what I have heard, the movie argues there is not just more, but much more surveillance done by the U.S. government than reported by Snowden in any and all revelations that he's given out so far. And as the movie wraps up, there's a spine-tingling suggestion at those secrets maybe coming out. What has been the impact, in your opinion, so far to these revelations by Edward Snowden? Because you've seen how they're not talked about on ABC, NBC, CBS News anymore. I'm not seeing a big rollback of government surveillance. I'm not doubting it will be. I'm seriously doubting that it will be an election issue, and the media seems to have grown bored of anything Snowden. So while we now know what happened with surveillance, has anything really changed other than we know that we're being watched?
Well, I mean, I don't disagree with your description of the way it's being handled in the media right now. I mean, one thing that I'll say is that outside of the United States, every Snowden revelation is front page news in countries around the world. Yes, I agree with you that there's Snowden fatigue here in the sense that, it was like, oh, the new shiny object, and there's this big story, and so it was like everything on the news right away. And then we go back to, whatever new ball of yarn the cats in the American media decide they want to bat around. And you can't blame blame Snowden or blame the journalists who are working with Snowden for the fact that other media outlets don't think it's of interest anymore because they're bored with the story. And I think, I mean, this is true on any number of issues in this country. Remember when we were talking about school shootings?
Yeah.
And it was like on the news constantly because it had just happened, and there was this whole debate about how we're going to try to confront, the threat posed by semi-automatic weapons being so readily available and then being used in these school shootings. And then we move on to the next thing. And then we're talking about what's happening in Ferguson, even though Ferguson still is in a major state of revolt. The media got bored with that, and they move on. There are a lot of ordinary people who have dedicated their lives now to responding to the police shooting in Ferguson, local folks there. And just because there's not cameras there following them around doesn't mean that they're still organizing, working, fighting on these issues. I also would say stay tuned on the Snowden thing because there is a tremendous amount of information that it has not yet come out that is going to come out. And we've been working on a system to try to really accelerate the pace of making the Snowden archive publicly available. And there's a lot of challenges involved with that, as you can imagine, given that Glenn Greenwald is in Rio, Laura Poitras is in Berlin, and we're trying to figure out a way where we can have more people going through the documents so that we can, in a responsible but public interest oriented way, put them out. On Laura's film, this is what I'll say to you. I've been involved with this from the very beginning. Glenn called me the night before he left for Hong Kong to tell me that he was going to meet with a new source and thought his life was going to change forever as a result of it. I thought I knew the Snowden story well. I was blown away when I saw Laura's film. You know, much of it takes place in this hotel room in Hong Kong, and it truly does feel like you're watching a thriller, and you learn an incredible amount about Edward Snowden and who he really is. And it gives lie to a lot of the narrative around him. And it's an incredibly powerful film. And yeah, I play a bit role in it, but I kind of cringed when I saw myself in the film. But all of the other, you know, minutes of the film that don't include me are absolutely riveting. And it's, if you think you know the story, you don't. And it's really amazing.
Well, I'm going to be emailing you to try to see if I can get some contact information on Laura, because I would love to have her on the show, because it's opening up here and I definitely want people to go see it. And I want to do everything I can to promote this movie because it sounds amazing and it sounds incredibly important. And when you're talking about the way in which the media, I love the idea of them being cats and playing with a ball of yarn, because look at that whole campaign, Jeremy, of hashtag bring back our girls. Now that that's completely ignored, they should start up a new campaign called hashtag bring back our girls, you know, because it's been completely ignored. One last question for you, Jeremy. We've been speaking with Academy Award nominee, two-time George Polk Award winner, co-founding editor of The Intercept, investigative reporter, war correspondent, author.
Enough. Ask the question.
Author of Dirty Wars, The World is a Battlefield. But I got to plug this, Jeremy. Jeremy will be speaking at the 35th Annual Dinner Celebration for Chicago Area Peace Action. It's a dinner in conversation with Jeremy Scahill, and it takes place Saturday, November 1 at 6 p.m. at the St. Francis Xavier Parish Gym, 549 9th in Wilmette. Tickets start at $20, $75 for the dinner. Find out more at chaipeaceaction.org. One last question for you, Jeremy, and as always, it's the question from hell, the question we hate to ask, you might hate to answer, our audience will hate this, your response. Erin Dottie Roy was on our show a couple weeks ago. We were talking to her about her book, Capitalism, A Ghost Story. In that book, she warns the pernicious nature of corporate foundations, how they will pay for students to be educated in the States and then send them back to their country of origin where they can do their corporation's neoliberal bidding. She specifically pointed out the Ford Foundation, but I pointed out that the Ford Foundation does some good things, like fun stuff like Democracy Now!, which you work on. When we had Glenn Greenwald on the show, we asked him about critics who pointed out that the person behind First Look Media, which is behind The Intercept, Pierre Omidyar, has political connections that some have found suspect, specifically his relationship with the new Ukrainian government. But Glenn pointed out that there is no impact by management on editorial content. So when it comes to corporate foundations and financial support from those who may not share your political views, should we take all the rope they're offering us, and will we end up hanging them or ourselves?
No, I mean, I think you need to be really careful. Look, I mean, if you had told me, I don't know, 2 or 3 years ago, certainly 10 years ago, that I would be working at a media outlet with a sole funder who was the founder of eBay and one of the 100 and whatever richest person in the world, I would have told you that you're smoking crack.
Right.
But, you know, I read a lot of the criticism of First Look Media. And I think it's good. I mean, I think it's really important that people are vigilant in not just holding public officials accountable, but holding journalists accountable. And, you know, I don't just dismiss all criticism or concerns. I actually take very seriously if it's not some wacko ad hominem thing, but it's someone raising serious issues. You know, I'll look at it. I mean, there are aspects of what Pierre Omidyar does that I'm totally opposed to politically. You know, he's engaged in all sorts of neoliberal economic initiatives around the world that, you know, I don't agree with and have criticized, you know, for years throughout my life. So if we were working for a media organization where that part of who Pierre Omidyar was or is, had some impact on our journalism directly, I would quit in an instant. If there was ever a moment where Pierre said, I don't want you to report on this, I would quit. It wouldn't be that I would have an argument. I would say, I am done. I'm not working here. So that's never happened. And if it does, I assure you that certainly Glenn, Laura Poitras, and myself will, the next day, we will not be working there anymore because we'll walk out. But we've got no indication that's going to happen. And the only thing I would say, and I think the criticism is great. The only thing I would say to people is, we're all in media right now, and I'm sure this is true, Chuck, with you too on your show. You try to figure out how do you sustain your journalism. How do you do it in a way that you have to spend the least amount of time scrambling to raise funds? How do you do it in a way that frees you up to spend almost all of your time doing reporting? And when this, you know, when Pierre Omidyar got in touch with Glenn Greenwald, at first we thought it was some kind of a joke. And that it wasn't really him. I mean, first of all, I had never heard of him before. But as we talked to him, we realized that he was serious. And you know, don't think for a minute we didn't consider all these questions. We did. But how do you fund independent media? Do you get grants? Do you do it entirely on donations? Do you sell advertising? Do you have a sole funder? Do you have a sort of mixed economy with how you do it? These are all questions we're dealing with. There's an existential threat facing independent journalism right now, and we're in an experiment that certainly has its flaws and its downsides, but we're trying to see if this works, and maybe it won't work. But right now I think it is working. We had some bumps in the road, but we're not going into this blind. We would never allow someone, because of the fact that they're our funder, to influence our journalism, and you can go to the bank with that one with me. I will quit in an instant if that ever changes.
Jeremy, it has really been a pleasure having you back on This Is Hell. People got to go see Jeremy on Saturday, November 1st at the Chicago Peace Action 35th Annual Dinner Celebration. Find out more at chaipeaceaction.org. Also, check out Jeremy's book, Dirty Wars, which just came out in paperback in September. Dirty Wars, The World is a Battlefield. You can find out more by going to dirtywars.org. Really a pleasure having you on the air. Huge mistake that I have your email address, so I'll be bugging you in the future.
No problem. I'll definitely tell Laura to do the show.
All right. Thank you very much. I really appreciate it, Jeremy.
All right, cool. Good talking with you.
Good talking with you. Take care.